Well, good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. And we welcome you also no matter what your age, whether you're very, very young or very, very old or in the middle, no matter what your abilities or even more important, your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we can get to know you better. Now, on Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're presented either by a Prairie member or a member of the wider community. We're still recruiting for a minister, a part-time minister, but we don't have one yet, so it's just us. And we're used to that because we were a lay-led congregation from the beginning and didn't have ministerial help for most of our history. Today, Jim Jager, sitting right here, will be presenting Who'll Decide for Mom? And it's about the end-of-life directives. Jim has kindly agreed to stay for a talk-back session from 11:30 until noon for more in-depth questions and discussion for those who can stay, and that'll happen right up front here, you know, at about 10 or 15 minutes after the service ends. You know, we have to give you time to visit a little bit. This Sunday, the service is by Jim Jager about the end-of-life directives, as I mentioned before. And again, remember that he'll be here for a talk-back session, meaning you can all talk with him at 11:30, because we probably won't have as much time as we want to talk to him during the discussion period. Jim is a student in the modified residency program of Meadville Lombard Theological School, which is the Unitarian Universalist Seminary in Chicago. He's also a night chaplain at Meritor Hospital, and he volunteers as a part-time chaplain at A-Grace, is that how it's pronounced?
That's what they're calling it.
A-Grace Hospice Care in Madison. He might tell us what that is. And he's also a longtime member of First Unitarian Society of Madison. I believe I first met him at Camp Unistar.
That's right.
Many years ago, 1980s, I think.
Yeah.
And he's also an elder law attorney in private practice. I think that means he advises elders. So, Jim Jager.
Yeah, it means more than I'm just an old lawyer, so. It's good to be back here at Prairie. I've had a couple of opportunities to speak here, and I always enjoy it. What I'm going to do to start the presentation today is show you an excerpt from a video prepared by Gunderson Lutheran Hospital over in La Crosse. Gunderson is a nationwide leader in what's called advanced care planning, which is the whole process of making sure that when the time comes, individuals' wishes with respect to their care, particularly their end-of-life care, is in fact carried out. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to show an initial excerpt from the video. We'll see how things go as far as at the end I may show at least one more excerpt. But this will sort of set the framework for my conversation this morning.
My mother has been chronically ill for several years, and within the past 6 months, her illness has really gone downhill. She's a diabetic with a severe heart condition, is legally blind. In December, she went into congestive heart failure, but was not coming out as quickly as she had in the past. She then, her condition complicated to the point where her kidneys had failed. Seeing her like that was very hard for me. I've never seen her that ill and that close to death. After the situation had gotten control, I went home. And that evening, I received a call from Dr. Dauber saying that your mother's condition is very, very serious. She is dying of kidney failure. I saw her today with the tube down in her respirator. I don't know how much more she can take. I phoned my family and they said, well, she's fine as far as forehead. And I said, that's fine. They brought her back. We'll do everything we can. So I phoned the doctor back and I explained it to him. And then the next question to me was, now in this procedure that we're going to be doing, your mother could have another arrest and not make it. What do you want to do? Well, at that point I thought, what are you, you know, telling me? What decision do I have to make? And he explained it in terms of what was my mother's quality of life. So as I looked at my mother's life for the past 6 months, it was, I didn't feel quality. I looked at the life of being in and out of the hospital, sitting in a chair throughout the day, not getting out. I couldn't call my mother and sister back and say, what should I do? I chose to eat my own food. I didn't want to keep her alive just for my own personal reasons or for anything else to make up for things in the past or whatever. I just felt that her quality of life at this time and all the suffering that she's had through her health at this point had to go. Well, unfortunately, after she got back on her feet and we discussed the living will as to if something else would happen, she didn't like this to be the idea that she was put on no coal, no resuscitation. And she said she wanted to live a little bit longer. And my reaction to that was, Mother, I did what I felt I needed to do. This was something that we did not discuss. I didn't know how we felt. And it was under an emergency situation. I should never have been put in a position like I was in a choice of others, left them in a choice for themselves. That was the choice they made is something they will have to contend with, and no one else will have to.
It was a morning like this, maybe 5-10 years ago. I was in my office and I got a phone call. I was told that a client of mine had just been admitted to the hospital. Now, given the nature of my practice, that's not an unusual event. I have a lot of clients in and out of the hospital. But in this particular case, it was a little different because I had agreed to be the healthcare power of attorney, the healthcare agent for this particular individual. And what I had found out was that she had been found in her apartment unconscious and had been taken to the emergency room. She was in her mid-60s, generally healthy except for the fact that she had recurrent lung cancer. And she apparently had had a stroke. And so I went down to the emergency room at University Hospital. Went in and saw her in the room. She'd been intubated. She was on the breathing tube and was stabilized, but was not conscious. And so I said, well, I'll come back in the evening. And so about 5 o'clock that afternoon, I went back over to the emergency room. And at that point, I had a chance to talk to the physician. I said, what's the plans here? He said, well, we think we ought to remove the breathing tube. And I said, okay, so if you do that, what's going to happen? They said, well, she'll probably die. Well, shortly prior to the time that this incident occurred, she was getting ready to move from her independent living apartment into a more supportive environment. And so she was really focused on that. I tried to get her to have the conversation, to talk about what she wanted. Oh, we'll do that later. Unfortunately, later was now. And I told the doctor, I can't make that decision. I really can't. I don't know what she would want. And so I went home that evening. I had some telephone numbers of people that I was instructed to call in the event of her death. These were friends of hers. She was somewhat alienated from her family. And so I called them, talked to two or three of them, and came away from the conversation thinking that, no, she would not want to go on like this indefinitely. And so after a rather sleepless night, I got up the next morning, and I went down to University Hospital, having steeled myself to be prepared to have them remove the breathing tube. And there she was, up in the ICU, wide awake, with the breathing tube. And so they removed it. She was fine. She could talk to me. Then we had the conversation. I'm telling you. And in fact, she ended up going into a nursing home, was there for several months, and died of natural causes. That experience made much more real to me the so-called process of advanced care planning. As was indicated in the video, we don't want to have somebody else have to guess what it is that we want to do. We want to make the decisions for ourselves. And so that's what I want to talk about this morning, a process that we call advanced care planning. I, for about 13 years, have served on the Ethics Committee at Oakwood Nursing Home. And over the course of that time, I met a woman by the name of Linda Briggs. Linda is a registered nurse, but her longtime work has been in the field of advanced care planning at Gunderson Lutheran Hospital. And I was, in my practice, was well into the notion of doing powers of attorney for healthcare. If you come to see me to have an estate plan done, and you don't have a power of attorney for healthcare, I will do my best to make sure that when you walk out of my office, you will have one. And so I was really focused on the document and getting the documents executed. And what happened was, in the course of working with Linda at Oakwood, she began to hammer into me the notion of this is more than just signing pieces of paper. This is a process. This is something that you have to think about. The legal background to this is fairly interesting. It started back in the 1970s with the Karen Ann Quinlan case. Ms. Quinlan was a young individual in her 20s who, for some reason not known to this day, collapsed during a party she was at. Taken to the hospital, put on the respirator, was in what doctors refer to as a persistent vegetative state, which is a state where there really is no activity above the brainstem. The limbic system, the nervous system, continues to function. But it was thought that if the breathing tube were removed, she would not continue to live. And at some point along the line, her parents made the determination she would not want to go on like that, petitioned the courts for authority to remove the breathing tube, the respirator. In fact, got that authority from the courts, removed it. But they did something that's become rather common, which is they weaned her from the ventilator. Weaning meaning they would take her off for short periods of time. And lo and behold, when they took it off, she didn't die. And she lived for another 17 years, still in a persistent vegetative state, on a feeding tube. The next major case was Nancy Cruzan. Nancy was another young woman who had a severe brain injury in an automobile accident down in Missouri. And at some point along the line, during the initial treatment, they inserted a feeding tube, thinking she was going to get better, what we call a bridge to getting better. And what happened in that case was, in fact, she did not get better. And so there came a point when her parents decided she would not want to go along like this. And so they petitioned to remove the feeding tube. Now, we've always looked at feeding tubes differently than we look at other kinds of medical intervention. There's something about taking away food, quote unquote, that hits a different nerve. And so the matter went to the Missouri, they were successful in the trial court. They go to the Missouri Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court says, no, the only way that you can remove a feeding tube is if there is clear and convincing evidence of what Nancy would want, and they didn't have such evidence in that case. Case goes to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says you do have a right to refuse unwanted medical treatment, and that right can be expressed by a surrogate decision maker, a guardian, a power of attorney, or whatever. But the state, with its interest in preserving life, has the right to set what level of proof they will require. And basically, they said in this case, the state of Missouri properly required clear and convincing evidence, which to us lawyers is something more than a preponderance of the evidence, but something less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. As it happened, what went on is, this case got a lot of notoriety. And when it went back to the trial court, the family got a call from some people. They say, you don't know us, but we knew Nancy. And we had conversations about this, and here's what Nancy told us. Based on that, they were able to go back to the court, get an order authorizing the removal of the feeding tube. In Wisconsin, we're in a little different situation. We have a case called Edna M.F. Edna was an 89-year-old woman who suffered from advanced Alzheimer's disease. And it was another situation, long-term feeding tube. They wanted to remove it. And ultimately, what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said is that if you're in a persistent vegetative state, then an agent under a power of attorney, or more importantly, a court-appointed guardian, can remove the feeding tube. But if you're not in a persistent vegetative state, they can only do so if there is, quote, clear evidence of what your wishes are. Now, I happen to think that the distinction they were making didn't make a lot of sense. I wrote a law review article that maybe three people have read and nobody has followed. But it sets a precedent in Wisconsin that is really problematic if you have not done advanced care planning. So what is advanced care planning? What do I mean by that phrase? Well, I see it as having a three-step process. The first step of that process is going on right here, within your own head. It's a process where you have to think about and consider what it is that you would want for medical decisions, not just end of life, but we'll focus on those because that's the focus of your series today, but any kind of medical decision. We're faced with some interesting and troubling statistics in some ways. When we went from the 19th to the 20th century, the average life expectancy was about 43 to 45 years. When we went from the 20th to the 21st century, the average life expectancy is about 79 years. Now, what's the impact of that? Well, the impact of that is that as you get older, it is more likely that you're going to be diagnosed with dementia or have some other condition that's going to render it so that you're unable to make your own decisions. The largest growing segment of our population is over age 85. At age 85, half of you will be diagnosed with some form of dementia. Right now, we have about 5 million people with dementia, primarily Alzheimer's disease, in the United States. If we don't do something about it, or if we can't find a way to cure it or to slow it down, by 2050, we're going to have 15 million people with Alzheimer's disease. So the likelihood is, the good news is you're going to live longer. The bad news is that at some point you may no longer be able to make your own decisions. And so you have to plan for that. And so the first step in the process is you have to think about these issues. And I don't think any of us want to think about the fact that we may die. And certainly we don't want to think about the fact that we may face an extended period of time when we're unable to make our own decisions for ourselves. But then who's going to decide for mom? So the first step in the process is the step in your own head. It is thinking about these issues. And how do you do that? Well, there's lots of material out there. There's material on the internet. There are what are called the Go Wish cards. If any of you have had a power of attorney for healthcare done at any of the local hospitals, there's a booklet called A Gift to Your Family that they often use when they're doing the power of attorney for healthcare. And in that book, there are a couple of things with ideas to talk about your healthcare issues. If many of you will remember, in the last election, we had this argument over death panels, the roving bands of government bureaucrats who's going to kill off grandma. Well, what this actually was a proposal that doctors actually be able to bill Medicare to talk with their clients about their wishes at the end of life. That's what these death panels were. And that's a big issue, because what we find is when people are given the opportunity to learn about what they're faced with and what the decisions are, in many cases, they're going to do what your friend here did today and said, yeah, you know what? I don't want that stuff. I've lived a good life. Time for me to move on. And so that's a process we need to go through. You need to spend time with your doctor, with your other medical people, with your minister, with anybody who can help you work your way through these decisions. So that's step number one. Step number two is to execute the proper legal documents to help carry out these decisions. Because we don't have in Wisconsin what is sometimes called a family consent law. A family consent law is one which says that if an individual is unable to make decisions for themselves and they haven't done any advanced planning, then what we will do is a certain people in certain orders of priority will get to make the decision. So if you're the spouse, you don't have the right to make the legal right to make the decision. Now, as a practical matter, what we call at the law school, law in action, what really happens at the bedside, as anybody who's been in a hospital knows or works in a hospital knows, if everybody's on the same page, they're probably going to, and there aren't the advanced directives, they're probably going to let people make the decisions. But shouldn't count on that, and we don't have the legal stuff to do it. And so what we have developed, because of cases like Cruzan and Quinlan and Edna MF, we have developed a series of documents that we call Advanced Medical Directives, or AMDs. And these are the documents that are in place so that people have the ability to have the legal authority to make these decisions. The oldest of these so-called AMDs is what we call in Wisconsin the Declaration to Physicians. Most other states would refer to this as a living will. A declaration to physicians, if you think about it, is here's the medical providers. And in the declaration to physicians, you're saying something directly to them. You're talking from here to here. And what you are saying is that if I am ever in a persistent vegetative state or in a, quote, terminal condition, unquote, which is defined to mean that your death is imminent if no action is taken, then you don't want certain things done. You don't want extraordinary measures to keep you alive. and perhaps you don't want tube feeding. Now, there's a couple of problems with that document. I mean, first of all, studies have shown that with just the declaration of physician or living will type document, very often it's just not honored. People, you know, if there's any controversy at all, people don't honor it. So it's unlikely, well, not unlikely, but it is less likely that you are going to have your wishes carried out with that kind of a document. Secondly, it fits a very limited scope of decisions. It only fits the end of life decisions, in effect, pulling the plug. But with Alzheimer's disease, with other dementias, with the after effects of a traumatic brain injury or a stroke, you may go on for many, many years. And there's going to be other decisions that need to be made. The consenting to surgery, the aspirin or the Band-Aid, all sorts of things where the doctrine of informed consent requires somebody giving permission. And the Declaration of Physicians just doesn't do it. And the Declaration of Physicians is only in effect when you're in a persistent vegetative state or terminal condition. And while life is probably a terminal condition, if you want to define it broadly, as practical matter, it's a really late in the process before you ever hit that. So it's a document that's there. I've used it in some cases where I will use it typically as if I have an elderly couple with no close friends or family nearby, so that I do power of attorney for healthcare so they can make decisions for each other, but then I have that kind of as a backup, but not as the sole document. The second document that we have in Wisconsin, or the second directive, is what we call the DNR bracelet. DNR means do not resuscitate. And typically you're going to run into that in a hospital or a nursing home setting where somebody will be what we call no code. So that if they go into respiratory or cardiac arrest, they won't be revived. But what about the person living in the community with terminal cancer, with advanced AIDS, where they're not going to be able to get any better? And they just decide that if in fact something happens, if I go into cardiac or respiratory arrest and the EMTs come, I don't want them to revive me. Well, what you can do in that situation is you can go to your doctor. The lawyer can't do it. The hospital can't do it. You have to go to your physician. The physician has to make the finding that you are in fact in that particular situation and prescribe this bracelet, which you will wear. So hopefully, when the EMTs find you collapsed, they'll look at it and say, oh yeah, this is a DNR. That's the newest of our advanced directives. The advanced medical directive that I believe should be the one that we use is what's called the power of attorney for healthcare. That works differently. You have you're the principal, you're the person signing it, you're here. You got the doctor or the nurse or the hospital or whatever over here, but in between, you've got this agent, this person to make healthcare decisions for you. And the idea behind that document is that you're going to tell the agent what you want, and then the agent's going to know this or have some idea of it so that when something comes up and you can't make your decisions anymore, that in that situation, they will then be able to make the decisions for you. Now, our power of attorney for healthcare is what we lawyers call a springing document. And what that means is the agent does not get authority at the point when you actually sign the document. All you're doing is creating the beginnings of a process. The document actually doesn't take effect, is not in effect for decision-making purposes until two doctors or a doctor and a psychologist have determined that you lack the capacity to make your own healthcare decisions. What is incapacity? Well, it is defined in the statute as the inability to receive, evaluate, or communicate information so you can effectively manage your healthcare. And so when two doctors make that certification, then and only then does the agent take over. Now, what kinds of decisions can the agent make at that point? Any kind. Anything, as I tell my clients, from as simple as and consenting to an aspirin or a Band-Aid, to the other end of the spectrum, consenting to surgery, turning off the machines. It is the whole spectrum of decisions that is authorized by this document. Now, in Wisconsin, we have some additional things that are built into our documents that you don't have in other states. And that's why if you are, let's say you live both part of the year in Texas or Arizona or Florida or whatever, another part of the year up here, I recommend that you have documents in both places because the ones from these other states may not work in Wisconsin. There's a couple of areas where this comes up. First area has to do with admission to either a nursing home or what we call a community-based residential facility or CBRF. In Wisconsin, if you are unable to admit yourself because of mental capacity to one of these kinds of facilities, your power of attorney or guardian can't admit you unless either you've got a power of attorney for health care that specifically authorizes the admission, or the guardian, you go through what's called a guardianship and protective placement. And the problem is that in other states, in particular Illinois, their document doesn't have that language. And in fact, the short form document they have in Illinois doesn't mention facilities at all. And so this can create some real problems if somebody's moving up here. So that's one of the first things that's unique about the Wisconsin document. The other thing about the Wisconsin document is there's a provision in there where you have to determine whether or not your agent specifically has the authority to withhold or withdraw a feeding tube. Now, feeding tubes, as I've said, is where a lot of the controversy has taken place. And the issue with the feeding tube is whether whether it is a bridge to recovery. For example, you've had a stroke. Often when you have a stroke, you lose the ability to swallow, but that can often be brought back through various kinds of therapy. But in the meantime, you need to be able to be fed. Or simply recovering from surgery, you may not have the ability to make the to be able to eat on your own. And so again, the hope is that you're going to get better, and the purpose of the feeding tube is to provide that bridge to recovery. Well, in those situations, many people would say, yeah, I want a feeding tube, because I'm going to be able to get back, and I may not receive all of my function, but certainly I will receive, get some of it back. And so for that reason, people may want. Now, on the other hand, if you're in the Nancy Cruzan situation or Terry Schiavo, where the feeding tube is simply going to keep your physical body going indefinitely or almost indefinitely, but there's no chance of you getting better, you may say, you know what, I don't want to go through that. More importantly, I don't want my family to go through it. So in the power of attorney for health care, you have to make those decisions. There's one other very important decision that has to be made. This is particularly for those of you who are 85-year-old women, and that is the question of healthcare decisions if you are pregnant. We have added to our document the category of not applicable, and I get some of the strangest looks. Okay, so who should be your agent? Well, I have three criteria that I suggest. One, somebody who shares or sympathizes with your views and values relating to healthcare. Or if they don't share them, they respect you and love you enough that they will carry out what you want, not what the agent wants. Secondly, that they're strong enough to make tough decisions, because you're asking somebody to decide whether someone lives or dies. And if any of you have been in that position, you know how tough that can be. And then finally, you need somebody who is aggressive and strong enough to be your advocate in the healthcare system, because anybody that's been in a hospital or a nursing home knows that in order to get really good care, either you or somebody else has got to be an advocate on your behalf. Now, that being said, the question, well, should it be the oldest child or the youngest child or whatever? And while I think that we older children, oldest children, should be given some degree of deference, in all reality, that's not the criteria. It's the criteria who you think can make the decisions. The other issue is, well, shouldn't it be the kid that's nearby? And the answer to that is, well, all things being equal, yeah. If you've got two equally good agents, and one is in Madison and one is in Alaska, probably better to have the person in Madison. But if the person in Alaska is clearly a superior decision maker, I'd make them the agent. The kinds of communications we have these days, it is hard for somebody not to be able to be communicated with. though I don't know what the cell phone coverage is in Alaska. So, you know, but so basically, I think you've got to look at the kinds of decisions that are going to be made. Now, when you sign this document, it's not like a forever thing. If you decide for some reason that you no longer want this particular agent or you want to change the nature of the decisions, as long as you have the mental capacity to do so, you can make those changes, revoke the document. And in fact, I think that even if you've been determined to be incapacitated, you can still revoke the document. And certainly the law is clear that if they're doing something you don't want, you can say, stop, don't do it. So that if they're putting you in a nursing home under the power of attorney for healthcare and you really don't want to be there, you can say, I don't want to go. Now, if they think you need to be there and you really can't make the decision, they can go for guardianship. Okay, so that's the second part. Get the document in place. Third part, just to kind of wrap things up and then we'll go to discussion. Communication. Obviously, you need to have the communication with the agent. They need to know what it is you want. But there may be other key players in the family or friend structure who, although they're not the agent, needs to know what's going on so they can understand that what the agent is doing is what you want. And so in that situation, you need, if you've appointed, you know, you've got four children, you've appointed child one and child two as the agents. You could appoint all four, but as long as it's in a certain order, but that's often not done. You need to sit down and talk with everybody in the family about what it is that you want and why. Because that's where a lot of the conflict comes into play. So who's going to decide for mom? Well, hopefully mom will make that decision for herself and who she wants to make that decision. And that she'll talk with them, that agent will know what it is that they want, and that the agent then will carry out their wishes. So why don't we take, I don't know, let's maybe take a few minutes for some discussion. Okay, so questions, comments? It's a good question. and it's a difficult question, because that really is very often the dilemma, is that people don't want to have these conversations. And all you can really do is push it as much as you can. More and more churches, civic groups, and all are beginning to talk about this. I mean, morbid to say, but one of the best times that we had in this country in recent years for this conversation was during the Terri Schiavo case. More and more people wanted, all of a sudden, these issues came to the fore and they wanted to talk about it. Maybe you're not maybe it's not you that is the one that will have to do it. Maybe their doctor needs to bring it up. It will certainly come up, if they're ever admitted to a hospital, it's going to come up because they're going to be asked under the Patient Self-Determination Act whether or not they have or want to execute an advance directive. And I can tell you that the hospitals in Madison are pretty aggressive about trying to get people to sign the documents. I don't know how much they do with the other pieces of the plan and really getting the people to talk about it and think about it, but by gum, they're going to have those documents signed. And so once the document's signed, particularly if he signs a document that appoints you as the agent, then you have every right to go to him and say, look, Dad, you want me to make these decisions? I have no idea what you want. You know, would you want to have a feeding tube forever? Probably he's going to say no. But at least you need to try to force it. If they aren't willing to have the conversation, you've tried. And then at that point, if you haven't been instructed in what to do, then what the statute says is that you try to make the decision that's in their best interest. Now, where the problem comes up is particularly as it relates to end-of-life decision-making, because, you know, the argument is, you know, is it not in somebody's best interest to be kept alive? And when we talk about being kept alive, we're talking about being kept alive biologically. Now, most of us, I'm guessing, particularly in this room, would probably say, well, that's really going to depend on the quality of my life. But in a lot of corners, it's going to be, you know, if the choice is between physically living and physically dying, physically living is better. And so that's where you get into this issue of what is in the best interest. But you know, at least broaching the subject, it may not, are his parents alive? Well, but the point is that what may bring him around is the day that he gets the call from the emergency room saying, Mr. So-and-so, your mother is here, and she, you know, this is her condition. What do you want us to do? And he goes, oh my God, I don't know. So that, you know, very often, frankly, in my practice, that's what brings people around, is when they have to do it for their elderly parents or relatives. I'm going to be here for like a half an hour or so afterwards, so we can get into this some more. So I will sit down.